Hello, welcome to Second Chances, the Persuasion Podcast. My name is Grace.
And I'm Tom.
And we are reading Jane Austen's Persuasion chapter by chapter. And this episode, we are reading Volume 2, Chapter 11, Part 2. So if you haven't listened to Part 1, go ahead and do that first and then come back to us here. So Tom, why don't you give us a quick recap of what happened in the first part of Chapter 11?
Well, what didn't happen? Basically, the most important event in the book. Anne was at the White Hart, where the Musgroves are staying. That's an inn. And she was talking to Captain Harville. It starts about talking about Bennick, because Harville is in Bath to get a miniature portrait of Bennick framed for Louisa that was originally commissioned for his dead sister, Fanny Harville. And they get into this whole conversation about who loves longer, men or women. And while they're having this conversation, Wentworth is like off to another part of the room writing a letter. And then after Harville and Anne are done talking, Harville and Wentworth leave. Wentworth comes back in a minute, is like, uh-oh, I forgot my gloves. Goes over to the desk where he was writing a letter. That's where Anne is now. And he pushes this letter towards her, and it's hastily addressed to Miss A.E., and the letter basically, and then Wentworth leaves, and Anne reads the letter, and it's his admission, I love you, I've always loved you, I'm here in Bath for you, like, give me a signal, I'm yours if you want it.
Come and get me.
And then Anne is, like, trying to recover from the emotional toll of this email, this letter, this physical handwritten letter, but she, you know, can't get any privacy at the White Hart, and here come Charles and Mary and Henrietta entering the room. They've just been out, like, on the town, and here they are back. Mm-hmm. So that's where we left off. Here, I'll read the last paragraph from the first part of the chapter we talked about, just to set us up.
Okay.
So Anne has just read the letter, and it says, "Such a letter was not to be soon recovered from. Half an hour's solitude and reflection might have tranquilized her, but the 10 minutes only, which now passed before she was interrupted, with all the restraints of her situation, could do nothing towards tranquility. Every moment rather brought fresh agitation. It was an overpowering happiness. And before she was beyond the first stage of full sensation, Charles, Mary, and Henrietta all came in."
Great. So yeah, like she's feeling these feelings, and it's almost like a record scratch with Charles, Mary, and Henrietta like bursting in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, well, so do you want to give us a really quick summary of what happens in the second part of this chapter?
Sure. Okay. So in the second part, Anne finds Wentworth, they talk. And they talk about, like, everything that has happened so far in the book, basically. And then the party happens, and, Lady Russell's there, and they talk a little bit about, really, Lady Russell, and, that's more or less kind of how the chapter ends.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, so we'll get into it.
Yeah.
So this part starts. "The absolute necessity of seeming like herself, for Anne, produced then an immediate struggle. But after a while, she could do no more. She began not to understand a word they said, anyone in the room said, and was obliged to plead indisposition and excuse herself. They could then see that she looked very ill, were shocked and concerned. It would not stir without her for the world. This was dreadful." So Anne is trying to, like, come up with an excuse to get alone, right? Mm-hmm. And how does everyone else react?
They are just, like, so, worried for her, and they like won't leave without her, and are just like, it's ironic because it's like, you know, at the start no one paid any attention to her.
yeah too much attention now.
Now she's got too much attention, she can't be alone.
They all see that she's looking like pretty pale and like, I don't know, not quite her like herself. Mm-hmm. And when all Anne needs is to be left alone, they're all crowding around her being like, what can we do? This was dreadful. Would they only have gone away and left her in the quiet possession of that room, it would have been her cure. But to have them all standing or waiting around her was distracting, and in desperation, she said she would go home.
"By all means, my dear," cried Mrs. Musgrove, "go home directly and take care of yourself, that you may be fit for the evening. I wish Sarah was here to doctor you, but I am no doctor myself." Sarah is like a servant. Mm-hmm. "Charles, ring and order a chair. She must not walk."
And remind everyone what that would mean, a chair, if they ordered a chair for Anne.
Like a Like a carriage?
Like a box, I think. Like one of these boxes that like two men would like carry on their shoulders.
That's right, I forgot about that.
a common service of the day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you make a good point. This is quite a full circle moment for Anne, from being totally ignored to having too much attention, right?
Yeah, it's funny now because it's like, if they were giving her the same treatment that they gave her, like, this is what she would prefer in this moment, is to be like, how she was treated by them earlier in the book.
Yeah, remember when no one cared about me? Can we go back to that a little bit, please?
Yeah, now she's like the center of attention. They literally can't move without her. She's like the queen bee, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And
all she wants is just a moment to herself.
Mrs. Musgrove's like, well, if you're gonna go home, Charles, get her a box.
She can't walk.
A chair, yeah. But the chair would never do. Worse than all, to lose the possibility of speaking two words to Captain Wentworth in the course of her quiet, solitary progress up the town, and she felt almost certain of meeting him, could not be borne. The chair was earnestly protested against, and Mrs. Musgrove, who thought only of one sort of illness, having assured herself, with some anxiety, that there had been no fall in the case, that Anne had not, at any time lately, slipped down and got a blow on her head, that she was perfectly convinced of having had no fall, could part with her cheerfully, and depend on finding her better at night.
I like that. Mrs. Musgrove's like, not again?
Well, to Mrs. Musgrove, it's like, if anyone's sick, it's got to do with a blow on the head, right? You don't look very well. Did you hit your head recently?
Do you remember hitting your head recently?
Yeah. And of course, I like this. The chair that's a terrible suggestion, because then there would be no way for Anne to catch up with Wentworth, right?
Right, yeah. Anxious to omit no possible precaution, Anne struggled and said, I am afraid, ma'am, that it is not perfectly understood. Pray be so good as to mention to the other gentlemen that we hope to see your whole party this evening. I am afraid there has been some mistake, and I wish you particularly to assure Captain Harville and Captain Wentworth that we hope to see them both.
What is this mistake or this confusion that Anne is worried about, you think? This possible confusion?
That she's going to be so unwell that, like, the party will be canceled?
I think so, that, like, she's sick enough to miss the party, and yeah, she really wants Wentworth to be there, right?
Mm. Yeah, because like, she's saying, like, oh, no, you misunderstand me in the beginning.
I'm not that sick,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Right.
I'm still going to be at the party, right?
I'm sick right now, but I will be at the party.
Yeah, yeah. So make sure that if you see Wentworth, make sure to tell him I'm going to be there, right? Harville and Wentworth.
Yeah. Don't worry, I'm still ready to rage later.
Mrs. Musgrove says, oh, my dear, it is quite understood. I give you my word. Captain Harville has no thought but of going. Well, of course, that's, you know, comically so. That's not who Anne was really concerned about getting the news.
Yeah. Do you think so? But I am afraid I should be so very sorry. Will you promise me to mention it when you see them again? You will see them again this morning, I dare say. Do promise me.
To promise to do what?
To tell the captains that she's going to the party.
Right.
And that she looks forward to seeing them. This is very cool. I mean, this is quite the, like, a very, what's the word?
It's getting a little brazen.
Yeah.
Of course, it's all lost on Mrs. Musgrove, who's only thinking of Captain Harville. Don't worry, Captain Harville's gonna be there, right?
Right, but it's also it's like the first time I've seen Anne so demanding. It's almost like she's practically, like, being like, swear to me that you will tell the captains that I will be there.
Well, Mrs. Musgrove says, to be sure I will, if you wish it. Charles, if you see Captain Harville anywhere, remember to give Miss Anne's message. But indeed, my dear, you need not be uneasy. Captain Harville holds himself quite engaged, I'll answer for it. And Captain Wentworth the same, I dare say.
Okay. Anne could do no more, but her heart prophesied some mischance to dampen the perfection of her felicity.
You never know. There's been a lot of mischances.
Yeah, I mean, so much hangs on the balance right now. It could not be very lasting, however. Even if he did not come to Camden Place himself, it would be in her power to send an intelligible sentence by Captain Harville.
Here comes that, like, certainty back again that we saw in the last chapter. It's like, we're not boy and girl anymore, you know, doomed to the caprices of fate. Like, this is gonna happen, basically,
yeah,
right?
This isn't some, like, what is it, like, comedy of errors where, a slight miscommunication will derail the entire relationship. They're grown-ups.
Okay. Another momentary vexation occurred. Charles, in his real concern and good nature, would go home with Anne. There was no preventing him. This was almost cruel. Just like fate, almost. But she could not be long ungrateful. He was sacrificing an engagement at a gunsmith's to be of use to her. And she set off with him with no feeling but apparent... But gratitude... Let me say that again. And she set off with Charles with no feeling but gratitude apparent.
That's gratitude funny. Apparent.
Yeah.
That's great. In real Charles fashion, he is... You know, he's gentlemanly, but he's also like, oh, I am sacrificing this gun show. Or this gunsmith that I was supposed to meet up with. Yeah.
And of course, the gun is for hunting. You know, Charles ever the sportsman. Okay, and I like this cut. Here we go. In the street. They were in Union Street when a quicker step behind, a something of familiar sound, gave Anne 2 moments preparation for the sight of Captain Wentworth. He joined them. But as if irresolute whether to join or to pass on, said nothing, only looked. Anne could command herself enough to receive that look, and not repulsively. The cheeks, which had been pale, now glowed, and the movements, which had hesitated, were decided. He walked by her side. So this is, here's Wentworth, doesn't say anything, and he just starts, like, walking along with them, right?
Mm-hmm. Anne and Charles are walking, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Anne and Charles are walking. Uh-huh. They see Wentworth.
Well, or she hears.
She hears Wentworth.
His step. She knows the sound of his step.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then he joins them, mm-hmm. not sure whether to go the same direction as them or to, like, I don't know, go his own way.
Yeah. So here's Charles. Anne is in the middle, and then here's Wentworth, and he doesn't even say anything. He just comes up and starts walking along with them a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And these are Wentworth's cheeks. The cheeks, which had been pale, now glowed. And Wentworth's movements. The movements which had hesitated were decided.
Yep.
Okay. Presently, struck by a thought, Charles said, Captain Wentworth, which way are you going? Only to Gay Street or farther up the town?
I hardly know, replied Captain Wentworth, surprised.
Are you going as high as Belmont? Are you going near Camden Place? Because if you are, I shall have no scruple in asking you to take my place and give Anne your arm to her father's door. Thank you, Charles.
Charles coming in with a great strike of a sudden thought.
Well, Charles, you know, he's having his own narrative here. He's like, wow, look at this good fortune. Now I can go look to that gunsmith. Here's someone to guide Anne, right?
Let me foist off this lady that I was just like 5 minutes ago volunteering to walk home. But now let me pass her on to like someone else.
Okay, yeah, he's like, give Anne your arm to her father's door. She is rather done for this morning. I feel like that's very modern phrasing, rather done for. She was rather done for this morning, and must not go so far without help. And I ought to be at that fellow's in the marketplace.
I love that. I ought to be at that fellow's in the marketplace. Like, that's where I need to be right now.
I've got an appointment. He promised me the sight of a capital gun he is just going to send off. Said he would keep it unpacked to the last possible moment, that I might see it. And if I do not turn back now, I have no chance. By his description, a good deal like the second size double barrel of mine, which you shot with one day round Winthrop. This is so many of Charles's pet, you know, obsessions. Hunting, guns, Winthrop. He loves Winthrop. Oh,
that's right, Winthrop.
Think of that property. I know you hate the haters, but think of Winthrop.
That's great. I love, this is peak, like, British humor, where it's, like, just so many obstacles getting in the way, and we have to now, like, listen to Charles rabble on about a gun and this gun show and this guy that who promised to leave the gun out for him. And
well, hey, this is more of Charles, like, low-key turning up as one of the heroes of this book at the end. And that's because we want no one else than Charles to be guiding Anne right now, because he's the only one selfish enough to be like, look, Wentworth, let me get out of here. I got something I'd rather be doing.
Yeah, I got weasels to chase. There could not be an objection. There could be only a most proper alacrity, a most obliging compliance for public view, and smiles reined in and spirits dancing in private rapture.
What is this saying here, Grace?
Okay. There could be only a most proper alacrity. Sorry, what's alacrity again?
Quickness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they responded quickly, but within the realm of it still being proper.
Gotcha,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. A most obliging compliance for public view, so that it's like they're not like be like, yes, we'll do it. Get out of here,
yeah,
Charles.
Finally, yeah. They're still like pretending like, oh, we're just acquaintances, right?
and smiles reined in and spirits dancing in private rapture. Mm. I love that. It's like they're just like giddy on the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
In half a minute, Charles was at the bottom of Union Street again, and the other two proceeding together. And soon, words enough had passed between them to decide their direction towards the comparatively quiet and retired gravel walk, where the power of conversation would make the present hour a blessing indeed, and prepare for it all the immortality which the happiest recollections of their own future lives could bestow.
Wow, that's great. I love this jump now to the future, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like, and this is like, and it's great. Like, it's very similar to, like, for example, the second proposal of Darcy's to Elizabeth. Like, we don't need to see it happening. We just know that it happened. In the same way that's kind of like here, it's like, we don't need the exact words that pass between Wentworth and Anne in this moment. Because it's like, it's almost like it's too sacred for us to read.
Mm, I like that, yeah. I also thought of Pride and Prejudice here, and just like, these engagements are happening the same way. They happen out of dialogue, and like reported dialogue, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like the narrator came, and it's like, and you know, they talked about the things that, you know, that you would talk about, and yeah. Yeah.
The actual proclamation of love itself is not put into dialogue in right. both these instances.
Yeah.
I think it's just like, it's kind of beside the point, you know? Mm-hmm. Why do you need to hear the exact words? You saw everything that led up to this, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
You saw
how it happened.
Right. And maybe even, like, to some extent, like, the words that they say to each other are not even, like, in this moment, probably, like, the words that they're saying to each other are just, like, not even enough mm-hmm. to encapsulate the feelings that they're feeling. So why should we read it if it's not even, like, an accurate representation of their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and prepare it being this moment in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
For all the immortality which the happiest recollections of their own future lives could bestow.
That's some, like, you know, what's the word? It's an oxymoron, like, recollections of their own future lives. It's like,
yeah,
it's like they're recollecting the conversations that they had about their future, right?
Yeah, well, they're recognizing in this moment that in the future, they will be thinking of this moment a lot, right? This moment is going to be immortal for them, basically. They're preparing this moment for the immortality it will enjoy in their future selves' memories, right?
That's right, yeah.
It's a very, like, sort of removed, you know, like, look at this scene that's happening. It's like, wow, think about how we're going to remember this moment when we're old, right?
It's like, yeah, it's like this, like, retroactive happily ever after. It's like we're gonna think about this moment as the moment we were gonna live happily ever after. So yeah, it's better than just saying happily ever after.
Yeah, or it's better than saying, like, they would never forget this moment. that is what it's saying, but it's, like, much more powerful than just, like, that, right?
Yeah.
They're prepared the moment for immortality.
There they exchanged again those feelings and those promises which had once before seemed to secure everything, but which had been followed by so many, many years of division and estrangement.
Yeah.
That's great. The many, many is, it's such a great way to just, like drive home just how long this has been in the running for, you know, how long this moment has been, like, how much time has been built for this moment to happen. There they returned again into the past, more exquisitely happy, perhaps, in their reunion than when it had been first projected.
Mm-hmm. Than in the first engagement.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're more happy now than they were when they first got engaged 8.5 years ago.
More tender, more tried, more fixed in a knowledge of each other's character, truth, and attachment. That's great. Well, yeah, it's this love between them has stood the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
More equal to act, more justified in acting.
Mm-hmm. More, what does this mean? More equal to act, more justified in acting.
More equal to act. Well, because now he's also, like, in a position. The equal part is, like, is that in reference to his position?
I think, well, equal is, like, able to. More able to act, right?
Yeah.
And what is the act? What is this acting?
To get married.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's saying they're in a better position to get married, right?
Yeah.
And they're more justified in getting married now.
Right.
Yeah.
She wasn't basically gonna elope, which is like kind of like what was gonna happen 8 years ago.
Yeah, and even going back to that conversation, that seemingly pointless conversation between Mrs. Croft and Mrs. Musgrove at the beginning of the chapter, like, there was that original engagement was one that was not gonna have a secure date, you know?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
But now they can, because now they're both, like, you know, established people in the
world.
Right,
there's less risk. And there, as they slowly pace the gradual ascent, heedless of every group around them, seeing neither sauntering politicians, bustling housekeepers, flirting girls, nor nursery maids and children, they could indulge in those retrospections and acknowledgments, and especially in those explanations of what had directly preceded the present moment, which were so poignant and so ceaseless in interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. They're like, yeah, it's just like this, like, this, like, this, you know, the world is just going on around them, and, like, they just don't even see it.
Uh-huh.
They're just walking, and, like, this bustling town full of, like, you know, people and, like, children and politicians and flirty girls. And,
yeah.
Like, it's all just, like, background noise.
I just think this is another great instance of how this is truly an urban novel, you know? And to contrast this with the proposal scene in Pride and Prejudice, they're in the country. There's no one around, you know?
That's right.
But here they are. Look at all these, like, characters that they're surrounded with. And I love this. Sauntering politicians, bustling housekeepers, flirting girls, nursery maids and children, just like all this life all around them, you know?
Mm-hmm. It is a very urban novel. All the little variations of the last week were gone through, and of yesterday and today, there could scarcely be an end.
Mm-hmm.
She had not mistaken him. Jealousy of Mr. Elliot had been the retarding weight, the doubt, the torment. That had begun to operate in the very hour of first meeting her in Bath. That had returned after a short suspension to ruin the concert, and that had influenced him in everything he had said and done or omitted to say and do in the last 4 and 20 hours.
Okay.
No, so we knew that.
Yeah.
We knew that already.
Yeah.
Freaking cock-blocking Mr. Elliot. It had been gradually yielding to the better hopes which her looks or words or actions occasionally encouraged. What is this it?
It, the jealousy, that
yeah.
is. Yeah, the
so
jealousy.
So his jealousy had been gradually yielding to the better hopes which her looks, words, and actions occasionally encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
It had been vanquished at last by those sentiments and those tones, again with the just the sounds of their voices,
mm-hmm.
which had reached him while she talked with Captain Harville, and under the irresistible governance of which he had seized a sheet of paper and poured out his feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot to talk about it in that moment, but there's a lot of great sounds in the beginning of this chapter, like the pin falling, the ceasing of the scratching, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, him trying, like, striving to catch sounds of her voice, and even in the very beginning when just the voice of Captain Wentworth alone was what, like, kind of sent her into, like, a fervor.
Right, and then we got Mrs. Musgrove, like, in this loud whisper.
Yeah, a lot of noise going on. And even in, as they're walking down the street, it's like a very noisy setting, you know, bustling housekeepers and sauntering politicians.
I mean, that's just like, you know, from a craft perspective, just like texture for the world,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Of what he had then written, nothing was to be retracted or qualified. He persisted in having loved none but her. She had never been supplanted. He never even believed himself to see her equal. Thus much, indeed, he was obliged to acknowledge that he had been constant unconsciously, nay, unintentionally, that he had meant to forget her and believed it to be done. He had imagined himself indifferent when he had only been angry, and he had been unjust to her merits because he had been a sufferer from them. So, I mean, we knew this, but here it is in literal print, is that he had meant to forget her, and he thought that he had, and he had believed that he was indifferent, but he was only angry.
Yeah. He was only lashing out at her
.
When he was, like, flirting with Louisa. He didn't care about Louisa at all.
And he had, like, thought, like, less of Anne than he should have, only because he had, like, you know, Anne has such, like, is such a meritorious person that she will do things that sometimes are even against her, what she wants, right? She will act against her own wishes sometimes.
Yeah,
right?
He has to, like, finally admit, and this is a hard thing to admit, which is that the meritorious thing for her to have done at the time, 8 years ago, would have been to reject Wentworth. That would have been the responsible, that would have been the responsible thing, the thing to do. It would have been like the, it would have been the right thing to do.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
unfortunately, yeah. It just so happens that the right thing to do hurt his little feelings.
Right. Okay. Her character was now fixed on Wentworth's mind as perfection itself. Maintaining the loveliest medium of fortitude and gentleness. But he was obliged to acknowledge that only at Uppercross had he learned to do her justice, and only at Lyme had he begun to understand himself. All right, there's going to be another paragraph that comes soon that I think maybe will be a more appropriate place to talk about this more, but I just think it's like it's great that it's all about Anne's character here. This is really what... why Wentworth is like, Anne, you were for me, and it's because you have, because of this character that you have, right? Mm. That is what attracts me to you most.
Your personality.
Exactly, yeah. It's truly an emotional connection.
Yeah. Okay, so her character is now fixed on his mind as perfection itself, maintaining the loveliest medium of fortitude and gentleness.
Right.
But he was obliged to acknowledge that only at Uppercross had he learned to do her justice.
Uh-huh.
So... Well, yeah, so what was it about her at Uppercross that showed him her fortitude and gentleness, her strength of character?
At Uppercross, it's kind of, I guess, just like the how she was able to be around him being such a heel, I guess. Like,
yeah.
How she was able to stand and be so, I don't know. To, like, so graciously accept, like, watching him flirt with two women at the same time, right? To watch him try to make a new attachment in front of her.
Mm-hmm. I think also...
Do you have other ideas? Yeah.
Well, we know now, and back then, he had always been watching her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think also just the fact that she... It's the same way that the Uppercross family fell in love with her, I think, is that she was just always so willing to help, so ready to help people, so, like... accommodating and always there and wanting to be helpful, wanting to be useful.
Yeah.
I think that's what he picked up on while she was at Uppercross.
And like just the opposite of selfishness, I guess. Yeah.
And only at Lyme had he begun to understand himself.
Meaning what?
Meaning, well, let's keep going. He'll explain it.
Okay, all right.
At Lyme, he had received lessons of more than one sort. Yeah, this is when the pissing contest starts. The passing admiration of Mr. Elliot had at least roused him, and the scenes on the Cobb and at Captain Harville's had fixed her superiority.
Okay.
So, yeah, Lyme taught him, hey, other men are looking at her too, and also, like, wow, she can really get her, keep things, you know, keep the ship, to use a naval metaphor, like, keep the ship going when there's, like, a disaster.
Yeah, happening. Well, Anne is good in an emergency. She was the best, she was better than him in that emergency.
Yeah, he caused the emergency.
Well, I like this, began to understand himself. It's like, well, he understood, like, he understands now that he always loved Anne, even if he was telling himself that he didn't, right? Mm-hmm. And he also understood, like, well, this is what I gotta do now, which is repropose to Anne, right?
Yeah, get out of this Louisa situation.
Yeah. And I like this, that, yes, it had roused him, Mr. Elliot's passing admiration. It's like, I guess there is something to see here.
Classic man. In his preceding attempts to attach himself to Louisa Musgrove, and in parentheses, the attempts of angry pride, he protested that he had forever felt it to be impossible to attach to Louisa.
Yeah.
That he had not cared, could not care for Louisa, though till that day, till the leisure for reflection which followed it, he had not understood the perfect excellence of the mind with which Louisa's could so ill bear a comparison. Or the perfect, unrivaled hold it possessed over his own.
So, here's an interesting question, is when he admits that he had attempted to attach himself to Louisa, right?
Mm.
Even though it was coming from angry pride. But he protested that he had never felt it to be, that he had felt forever, that he had forever felt it to be impossible. So, was, even when Wentworth was flirting with Louisa, was he ever thinking that I do want to be attached to her? Or was it always just like, did he always know in his mind that he never wanted to be with Louisa, despite having made attempts to attach himself to her? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or did this realization come to him later that he never actually wanted to be with her?
In his preceding attempts to attach himself to Louisa, he protested that he had forever felt it to be impossible.
That he had not cared, could not care for Louisa. Though till that day, yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think, yeah, the whole time he realized, like, he just knew that he would never feel attached to Louisa. And it wasn't until that day that...
The day in the cob.
The day in the cob that he felt even further, like, oh, not only is it impossible for me to feel anything for Louisa, but also, like, I'm realizing now in this moment just how superior Anne is to Louisa.
Right. So he always knew, I mean, this doesn't look great for Wentworth. Mm. He was trying to attach himself to Louisa out of angry pride, but he always knew that Louisa was not the right person for him.
Mm.
But not until in the cob did he realize that Anne was the only person for him, right?
Yeah. Or how much, like, Anne was just always on his mind, I think.
Or, yeah, and I mean, just going back to the whole nut comparison, like, when they're out on the road.
Yeah.
I think that's when he realized, like, oh, actually, Anne has the stronger character, right?
Yeah.
I thought, even if it wasn't Louisa in particular, I thought I could love someone like Louisa, or I thought that's who I was looking for.
Yeah.
But then, after the scene on the cop, he realized, oh, I've just been looking for Anne the whole time. She was always my ideal, right?
Yeah, that's when he realized the perfect, unrivaled hold, Anne's mind possessed over his own.
Mm-hmm. And Anne had, like... She is the strong nut. She has the fortitude he was talking about.
Yeah.
He just didn't realize it in the moment.
Right. Because his pride was hurt. There, I guess at the cob, he had learned to distinguish between the steadiness of principle and the obstinacy of self-will. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The steadiness of principle is Anne.
Yeah.
And the obstinacy of self-will was Louisa. Between the darings of heedlessness and the resolution of a collected mind.
Mm-hmm.
There, he had seen everything to exalt in his estimation the woman he had lost, and there begun to deplore the pride, the folly, the madness of resentment, which had kept him from trying to regain her when thrown in his way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we kind of knew that already, you know. Well, actually, it's interesting here that here saying, like, even though coming back 8.5 years later, like, Anne was right there for the taking. He could have just, like, seeing Anne as the perfect woman for him, he could have just proposed again, but his pride wouldn't let him.
Well, I think this is also when he realizes that, Anne, like, when he's saying that Anne, when he sees how Anne acts on the cob, and he realizes that Anne has the truly superior character of any woman he's met, of any person he's met, right?
Mm.
I think it's him starting to realize that Anne was not so wrong in rejecting him in the first place. It's coming around to the idea that Anne didn't reject him just out of weakness of character, that it was, in fact, the strength of her character that allowed her to reject him. And, like, I think it's him starting to come around to understand why she behaved the way she did, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From that period, his penance had become severe. He had no sooner been free from the horror and remorse attending the first few days of Louisa's accident, no sooner begun to feel himself alive again, than he had begun to feel himself, though alive, not at liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to keep going?
Sure. I found, said he, that I was considered by Harville an engaged man, that neither Harville nor his wife entertained a doubt of our mutual attachment. I was startled and shocked. To a degree, I could contradict this instantly. But when I began to reflect that others might have felt the same, her own family, nay, perhaps herself, I was no longer at my own disposal. I was hers in honor if she wished it. I had been unguarded. I had not thought seriously on this subject before. I had not considered that my excessive intimacy might have its dangers of ill consequence in many ways, and that I had no right to be trying whether I could attach myself to either of the girls at the risk of raising even an unpleasant report were there no other ill effects. I had been grossly wrong and must abide the consequences.
So here's kind of the, like, reason that we can't or that we shouldn't maybe be so hard on Wentworth in regards to how he was so openly flirting with Louisa is that he, you know, has been in the Navy for 8 years. He doesn't know the machinations of courtship.
Mm.
So, yeah, like what you were saying earlier, like, he thought it was all just, they were all just having a good time. But then the Harvilles had to kind of, like, knock some sense into him and be like, hey, like, what you're doing right now, you are basically, you're ostensibly engaged.
Everyone thinks you're engaged.
To Louisa. Yeah. Yeah, so you need to, like, get your shit together and, you know, in true gentlemanly form, he acted as if they were engaged. He didn't, like, reject her, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Wentworth is like, he says, I understood that I did wrong, and if Louisa wanted to marry me after she came out on the other side of it, I had no choice but to say yes. It was the only, like, right thing to do, right?
Yeah. So he would have married her.
Yeah, even though he would have made him miserable.
Yeah. Ugh, golly. And then the story would have been over.
Well, that's kind of his penance. That's his penance for, unfortunately, it involves a woman getting concussed.
Yeah, he secretly might have wished that she would have just died. Okay. He found too late, in short, that he had entangled himself, and that precisely as he became fully satisfied of his not caring for Louisa at all, he must regard himself as bound to her if her sentiments for him were what the Harvilles supposed. So there's some bitter irony is that the moment he realized, Anne has always been the one for me, is when he is basically, like, by all intents and purposes, engaged to Louisa.
Mm.
Okay. It determined him to leave Lyme and await her complete recovery elsewhere. It's a nice way of putting it. He would gladly weaken, by any fair means, whatever feelings or speculations concerning him might exist. And he went, therefore, to his brother's, meaning after a while to return to Kellynch and act as circumstances might require.
Okay. It says, I was only 6 weeks with Edward, said he, and saw him happy. I could have no other pleasure other than seeing him happy. I deserve none. He inquired after you very particularly, asked even if you were personally altered, little suspecting that to my eye you could never alter.
Well, according to Mary's account of what he said at the party.
But how does Anne react to this?
Anne smiled and let it pass. It was too pleasing a blunder for a reproach. It is something for a woman to be assured in her 28th year that she has not lost one charm of earlier youth. So even though she's an old lady, a spinster at almost at 28 years old, it's still nice to hear that she's still got her youth.
Well, that's one thing. Yeah.
That's one thing. Uh-huh. But the value of such homage was inexpressibly increased by Anne, by comparing it with former words and feeling it to be the result, not the cause, of a revival of his warm attachment. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Anne is like, that's not what you said at the party, but she lets it pass.
Yeah, yeah. It's too pleasing a blunder to reproach
it. Because number one, and this is kind of a universal sentence here. It is something for a woman to be assured in her 28th year that she has not lost one charm of earlier youth. So she's like, I'll take it. Even if it's not true, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's nice. But
The value of such homage was inexpressly increased to Anne by comparing it with former words.
Mm.
So she's just like, well, I'm glad to hear that now as opposed to what you said earlier.
And those former words were, she was so altered, I didn't even recognize her. That's what Wentworth said, yeah.
And here's the kicker is that she feels it to be the result of a revival of his attachment, not the cause.
Yes, so seeing that she is just as beautiful as ever is the result of him falling in love with her again, and that, but that's not what caused him to fall in love, right?
Right.
He didn't fall in love with her again because, like, oh, look, she's just as beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks she's just as beautiful after he falls in love with her again, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of maybe, like, a funny way. It's kind of like a, you know, depending on how you read it, it's like, would you rather someone see you as beautiful as ever after they've fallen in love with your character, or do you want them to fall in love with you because you are as beautiful as ever? And I think what Anne prefers is the former, is that she prefers that he sees her as beautiful because he has fallen in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it kind of seems like a subtle dig at her outward appearance right now.
Well, I think it's, and speaking to what I was talking about earlier, this is, like, truly a love of the heart, you know?
Yeah.
The physical follow, there is the physical, but that follows the emotional, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He, like, when he thought he wasn't in love with Anne, she wasn't pretty to him. But now that he's in love with her again, she's as beautiful as ever, right?
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to how Anne is more concerned with, like, you know, character and interior, like, who a person is on the inside, and, like, thinks that a match based on emotional love is always superior to one based on physical, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we shouldn't forget, like, Anne did change, her appearance did change after she left Kelly, and she, like, right at the start when she was living at Upper Cross, she was fresh out of Kelly and probably did look awful, but then, you know, going to Lyme rejuvenated her.
Yeah, she's regained her bloom.
She's regained her bloom. Yeah, whatever that means. So it's like, yeah, the color returned to her cheeks or something. I don't know. So it's like, yeah, like, on the one hand, he probably does see her as beautiful because he's in love with her. But also, like, there may be some just real, like, actual, like, change in her outward appearance after she went to Lyme.
Well, and, like, Anne is, you know, Anne is pretty, especially, you know, when she's younger, and people come in Bath, she comes to be seen as, you know, the thinking man's choice compared to her sister. But I think that's part of the project of Persuasion, is Anne is not, like, the beautiful young ingenue, you know, am I saying that right?
I think so, yeah.
And Anne is, like, you know, would be a supporting character in any other book. Right.
That's right.
And I think it's even, like, challenging the conventions of romance to be, like, Anne liked it better that Wentworth, like, was more in love with her character than was physically attracted to her, you know?
Yeah.
It's not, like,
it's her personality that informs her beauty, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And that's more important to Anne.
Yeah. And it should be more important.
And we never see, like, Wentworth, you know, there's no pay-ons to, like, the beauty of Anne, right?
That's true, yeah. No one is, yeah.
It's all, everything Wentworth is saying is about her character.
Which is what Anne, you know, which is what Anne prefers.
Uh-huh.
And which is also what Anne, values.
And I think that's also what Austin values. I think it's pretty safe to
say. That's safe to say, yeah.
And I think that's also what she's pushing for in, like, her own romances, is don't think about these characters' physical appearances. You know, that's not what's important.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes it's the most attractive man that is the bastard in the book.
Yeah, exactly.
So don't trust pretty men.
Or women.
Or women.
Okay. Wentworth had remained in Shropshire with his brother, lamenting the blindness of his own pride and the blunders of his own calculations, till at once released from Louisa by the astonishing and felicitous intelligence of her engagement with Benwick. So there's felicity and marriage, you know, the felicitous intelligence.
Felicitous intelligence, yeah.
That's a fun phrase.
Well, it's funny, yeah, I mean, the felicitous is definitely working both ways in this particular sentence. It's like felicitous marriage-wise, but also I'm sure he was over the moon when he found out.
This is like the governor, like, giving Wentworth an 11th-hour pardon or something, this news.
Yeah, he is true. You're right. He was truly, like in the gallows when someone decided, oh, no, you're free.
Woohoo!
Also interesting, we never get to really meet Mr. Wentworth, his brother.
We don't, but he remembers Anne.
Yeah.
And he was probably privy to information when in their initial courtship.
Well, it's funny, even way back in, like, chapter 3, the way we hear about Captain Wentworth is in relation to Mr. Wentworth.
Because Mr. Wentworth lived in the neighborhood for a while.
Mr. Wentworth, the brother.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. It's like, oh, like, very much early in the beginning, you think this story is going to be about a Mr. Wentworth, but it's, like, nothing to do with Mr. Wentworth.
Yeah,
it's his brother,
the
captain.
Well, now we know this is where he went to recover, to hide while Louisa was recovering.
Yeah.
Here, said he, ended the worst of my state. For now I could at least put myself in the way of happiness. I could exert myself. I could do something. Right? I can... At least I'm not engaged to Louisa, right?
Mm-hmm.
I might not get back with Anne, but at least I don't have to marry Louisa. I can at least try to win Anne back. But to be waiting so long in inaction, and waiting only for evil, had been dreadful. Within the first 5 minutes I said, I will be at Bath on Wednesday. And I was.
Okay, this is very interesting. I just noticed now... I could exert myself, I could do something, but to be waiting so long in inaction and only waiting for evil had been dreadful. That's women. He's describing how women live.
He gets like, a little taste of his own medicine.
Yeah. In the conversation between Anne and Harville, this is like what Anne was getting at.
It's almost like Louisa is at sea right now. And he's like, I don't know, or something. Yeah. Yeah. He's stuck at home, like letting his feelings torment him, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, then, yeah. Except, you know, he gets the option of within the first 5 minutes, I said, I will be at Bath on Wednesday, and I was.
Well, he can act for his own happiness, yeah, and right. And it's not so easy for Anne.
Right, he didn't have to sit around for 8.5 years. He could do whatever he wanted.
But more just, you know, and this is classic, like, narrative, you know, going back to, like, Greek tragedy, just like him talking about pride. It's essential. It's like, I was proud, and I've been humbled, you know.
Yeah, and it takes a big man to admit that. It takes a really... You know, I think we've talked about this in Pride and Prejudice, is that, you know, the reason they deserve each other, Elizabeth and Darcy, is because they change. They recognize their follies, and they change, and then they're better off for it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens here. It's like Wentworth, specifically Wentworth, because Anne is basically faultless.
Yeah.
Wentworth realizes his folly, which is his pride, and he has to change for it, and then he deserves Anne.
I can tell you, Austin would not let this match happen if Wentworth didn't, like, disavow his former actions, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least, like, acknowledge that he had acted improperly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so... He's been waiting around to hear whether Louisa's gonna die or want him to marry him. But as soon as he hears that Hera and Benedict are engaged, he's leaving a Bath in the first 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Getting out of the first train.
Was it unpardonable to think it worth my while to come and to arrive with some degree of hope? You were single. It was possible that you might retain the feelings of the past, as I did, and one encouragement happened to be mine. I could never doubt that you would be loved and sought by others. But I knew to a certainty that you had refused one man, at least, of better pretensions than myself. And I could not help often saying, was this for me? So who's he talking about here?
Charles.
Yeah, yeah. So he knew that she turned down Charles Musgrove.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that Charles Musgrove had much better pretensions than Wentworth.
Yeah.
His family's got money. They live, like, very close to each other. It makes sense for the Anne-Charles Musgrove match to happen.
Even though it seemed like there was that miscommunication where the Musgroves thought it was Lady Russell who, again, dissuaded Anne to marry Charles. Even though Lady Russell wanted her to marry Charles.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Musgroves thought that. We don't know how Wentworth gets this information.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, if that is, in fact, the information that the Musgroves gave to him, then he had to have thought about it more critically and be like, that can't be the reason. The reason possibly was because of me.
Was this for me?
Yeah. Which is a big leap to get. If you're actively trying to not be in love with someone, and then for that nagging thought in your head to be like, oh, maybe she rejected him because of me. Even though it seems like that, the family thought she rejected him because of Lady Russell.
I think that might be short-sightedness on the Musgroves' part. I think it's fair to say Wentworth knew enough about, like, he knew his own circumstances to know that Lady Russell would probably support that match. He acknowledges that Charles Musgrove had better pretensions to...
Yeah, sorry guys, that's my alarm.
okay, all right. But, yeah, so he's like, I've often been asking myself, however he found out this information, did Anne turn down Charles Musgrove for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the first meeting in Milsom Street afforded much to be said, this is the narrator now, but the concert still more. That evening seemed to be made up of exquisite moments. The moment of her stepping forward in the octagon room to speak to him, the moment of Mr. Elliot's appearing and tearing her away, and one or two subsequent moments, marked by returning hope or increasing despondence, were dwelt on with energy. To see you, cried he, in the midst of those who could not be my well-wishers, to see your cousin close by you, conversing and smiling, and feel all the horrible eligibilities and proprieties of the match, to consider it as the certain wish of every being who could hope to influence you. Even if your own feelings were reluctant or indifferent, to consider what powerful supports would be his, aka who?
Lady Russell.
Lady Russell. It's like, I saw you with Mr. Elliot, and even if I suspected that you were still in love with me, like, There's so much in Mr. Elliot's favor.
Yeah,
right?
Everyone is backing that horse, to speak.
Was it not enough to make the fool of me, which I appeared? How could I look on without agony? Was not the very sight of the friend who sat behind you, was not the recollection of what had been, the knowledge of her influence, the indelible, immovable impression of what persuasion had once done, was it not all against me?
Well, we kind of saw that. Yeah, we knew that, too. Like, the funny, Bath is now, like, you know, Bath has more or less said, oh, you know, Mr. Elliot and Anne Elliot are going to get engaged any time now, and we're all for it, and it's great.
Captain Wentworth almost has a sort of penetration into Lady Russell's character also.
Mm.
Maybe this might not be entirely accurate, but it seems to me he might have some understanding of where Lady Russell stood on the question of Charles Musgrove. It seems very clear that he knows that Lady Russell would support Mr. Elliot's claim, which he does.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, proposal, that is.
Yeah, just the way that he describes it, the very sight of the friend who sat behind you, basically like the devil on your shoulder, or just like some, the person whispering things into her ear.
And it's interesting, he's like, how could I look on without agony? It's not the sight of Elliot that's Mr. Elliot that's making him agonize, it's the sight of Lady Russell.
Mm. Well, she was the first blockade. She was the one who persuaded Anne in the first place. Maybe it's like Anne, or he wasn't sure what Anne was feeling towards Mr. Elliot, but he knew how much Anne cared about Lady Russell's opinion. So.
He's like, she's going to do it to me again. I'm going to get up the nerve one more time, and Lady Russell is going to stand in my way one more time.
Okay, Anne goes, you should have distinguished, replied Anne. Mm. You should not have suspected me now. The case so different, and my age so different. If I was wrong in yielding to persuasion once, remember that it was to persuasion exerted on the side of safety, not of risk. When I yielded, I thought it was to duty, but no duty could be called in aid here. In marrying a man indifferent to me, all risk would have been incurred and all duty violated.
Mm-hmm.
So her point is like, when Wentworth says, you know, everyone was for the match between you and Elliot, and I saw the woman who persuaded you to not marry me sitting there again, probably whispering to you that you should marry Mr. Elliot.
Right.
And Anne is saying, well, you should have known that the case is very different now. Yeah. The circumstances are different. It's not like she just, like, willy-nilly, like, listens to... It's not a repeat of the past, because the circumstances are different.
Right. Well, and what are the circumstances now?
Well, first of all, they're older.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're older, and... When she was persuaded, well, here's the interesting thing. The thing is, she seems to think, like, she in rejecting Wentworth, she did it out of safety, not risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here it seems to be that if she were to marry Mr. Elliot, that would actually be the risky thing to do.
Right.
Because she doesn't love him.
And she thinks he's indifferent to her as well.
Yeah.
Which is probably true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she's like, not only am I older, but remember, when I first rejected you, it was because our future was uncertain as a married couple, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why would I then jump into another match where the future would be uncertain, right? It's not financially this time, it's emotionally. But what were you going to say? Sorry.
Oh, yeah, just that. Like, yeah, it's interesting here. The duty that she's describing is, like, duty to, like... Herself,
yeah. All duty violated. / the divine duty to, like, marry someone who's right for you, kind of, right?
That's right.
The duty of marriage.
Yeah.
And, like, to marry someone who's truly in love with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess she just saw straight through at Mr. Elliot.
Yeah, that's also true.
Like, he doesn't love me. He can just use me, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess so, yeah. It's a very interesting take here, because... Yeah, because, well, she's saying the first time she did it out of duty to her family,
mm-hmm.
in rejecting the man that she loved. I don't
right.
know, it's hard to, I guess, but she's using duty in a different way there. That the first time is duty to her family, but the second time is, like, duty to herself.
Mm-hmm.
But duty to herself the first time around would have been to marry Wentworth, right? Because that's who she loved.
But it might not have... Like, emotionally, maybe, but not, like, you know, in practicality.
Yeah.
It might have created, you know, it might be doing a disduty to herself, mm-hmm. a disservice to jump into a marriage that is uncertain, to get involved, like, to, you know, let's say in a long engagement, to get engaged with no, like, view of how are we going to make this marriage happen, right?
Yeah. I guess so, yeah. Okay. It is, I guess, just, like, the bigger sin to marry someone you don't love than it is to not marry someone you love.
I think she's like, you should have known. You should have known that I didn't love Elliot, and that I wouldn't have taken that huge risk of marrying a man I don't love because of persuasion, right? Mm-hmm. What I was originally persuaded to do was to be, like, to not take a risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why would I now allow myself to be persuaded into a risk?
I guess so, yeah. Mm.
Why? What's up?
I guess it's just sort of like the, maybe it's like the age, the factoring the age into consideration. It's like, I don't know. I still don't get how, like, outwardly, I guess it just seems like the only duty being violated in marrying Mr. Elliot is, like you said, the divine duty of, like, not being honest with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she says, when I yielded originally, I thought it was to duty, but no duty could be called an aid here. It's almost contradictory. She's like, well, there's no duty in marrying, like, well, what duty would I be fulfilling in marrying Mr. Elliot, mm-hmm. right? In fact, it's the opposite. Like, the duty I have is to not marry a man who I think is indifferent toward me.
That's true. I guess the duty would be, like, she would take her mother's place as, like, Lady Elliot of Kellynch, which is what Lady Russell was talking about. It's just, like, it almost seemed like Lady Elliot would be like, it is your duty to marry Mr. Elliot uh-huh. and take the place of your mother.
Well, I guess that just speaks to how Anne is older, and she can see that, like, just because Lady Russell says it so doesn't mean it is, right?
I guess so, yeah. Okay, so then what does he say?
Perhaps I ought to have reasoned thus, he replied, but I could not. I could not derive benefit from the late knowledge I had acquired of your character. I could not bring it into play. It was overwhelmed, buried, lost in those earlier feelings which I had been smarting under year after year. So even when Wentworth comes to Bath, like, I'm here to win Anne, those bad feelings still arise sometimes, especially when he sees Elliot, Mr. Elliot and Lady Russell, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, I saw the two of them, I saw Mr. Elliot flirting with you, and then I looked at Lady Russell, and all those bad feelings came back, right? And I started questioning myself again, and I started questioning you.
Yeah.
I could think of you only as one who had yielded, who had given me up, who had been influenced by anyone rather than by me. I saw you with the very person who had guided you in that year of misery. I had no reason to believe her of less authority now. The force of habit was to be added.
I should have thought, said Anne, that my manner to yourself might have spared you much or all of this.
No, no. Your manner might be only the ease which your engagement to another man would give. I left you in this belief, and yet I was determined to see you again. My spirits rallied with the morning, and I felt that I still had a motive for remaining here.
Okay, so.
So he's like, yeah, I gave you up for dead, but I didn't leave, right? I stuck around.
Mm-hmm. And the only reason for that was because of the manner that she spoke to him, in which she spoke to him. Was the only thing that gave him hope to keep trying.
This kind of, it makes me think of that, the Harville speech from the beginning of this chapter, but, like, the soldier coming home trying to be like, well, I can't, you know, my family's not going to be here that soon, you know, so that they're not disappointed. It's almost like he's doing those same kind of, like, mental gymnastics.
Yeah, like the mental math of, like, how much torture can I take?
Right. Well, it's almost like he's trying to convince himself. She's gone, she's engaged to Mr. Elliot, and Lady Russell has made it all happen. It's almost like so that he won't be disappointed if that's the truth.
Yeah. It's actually, yeah, like, we saw Anne make moves at the concert. She knew that she had to talk to Wentworth to, like, basically give him hope, you know, make sure to convey to him that she's not engaged to Mr. Elliot. And it worked. Here we have proof that it worked, because that was the only thing keeping him from jumping into the river, into the water.
Well, let's hope that maybe, even though he was feeling still smarting under those old pains, that, like, underneath it, he had that penetration that Anne is telling him. Like, underneath the emotions, he could see that Anne still loved him.
Mm. Okay. At last, Anne was at home again. So they made it home. He dropped her off. At last, Anne was at home again, and happier than anyone in that house could have conceived. All the surprise and suspense and every other painful part of the morning dissipated by this conversation, she re-entered the house so happy as to be obliged to find an alloy in some momentary apprehensions of its being impossible to last. Okay. All the surprise and suspense and every other painful part of the morning dissipated by this conversation. Mm-hmm. She re-entered the house so happy as to be obliged to find an alloy in some momentary apprehensions of its being impossible to last. So there's still like a dark thought penetrating through all of this.
And it's like, I'm almost too happy right now. I gotta realize, hey, this can't last forever, right? Yeah. She has this like apprehension that she says is an alloy to the overwhelming happiness she's feeling, right?
An interval of meditation, serious and grateful, was the best corrective of everything dangerous in such high-wrought felicity. I feel like this high-wrought felicity has appeared before in this book, but I can't remember where. And she went to her room and grew steadfast and fearless in the thankfulness of her enjoyment. So yeah, it's like, you can be happy, but you can't be too happy. You have to like be able to like temper your happiness, which is a very interesting thought.
Yes, it was the best corrective of everything dangerous in such a high-wrought felicity. Yeah, what's the danger?
That, I don't know, like, that it's I don't know. What's the danger? The danger is that you're too happy.
That you're going to be disappointed. I don't know.
That it's like indecorous to be so
maybe
happy.
Maybe she's going to like give it up, like reveal that she, I don't know, it's going to like reveal to everyone else that she's engaged.
Maybe, yeah. Okay. Or I just like,
go ahead.
I think the thing that she thinks about is that like this happiness is impossible to last. Like,
I think it's just, like, she's, like, I'm getting carried away with my emotions now. And I need to, like, add some, like, logic and reason to it.
Maybe. Yeah, fair. Yeah, you shouldn't be swept up by your emotions.
It says it's a momentary apprehension of it being impossible to last. I mean, I believe it for Anne's character. Like, it's almost, like, too much good news. Like, she's just been, like, this whole book telling herself, this is never gonna happen. Mm-hmm. It's just happened. And she's like, well, there's gotta be that moment of, like, well, what's gonna ruin this, right? Is something gonna stop this now?
Yeah, like, I need to get my feelings in order. Yeah. Get my ducks in a row.
I guess it's just, like, I gotta still be, like, safe somewhat, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite all resolved, quite yet.
The evening came, the drawing rooms were lighted up, the company assembled. It was but a card party. It was but a mixture of those who had never met before and those who met too often. A commonplace business, too numerous for intimacy, too small for variety. But Anne had never found an evening shorter.
Mm-hmm.
Glowing and lovely in sensibility and happiness, and more generally admired than she thought about or cared for, she had cheerful or forbearing feelings for every creature around her. Mr. Elliot was there. She avoided, but she could pity him.
Mr. Elliot is so benign now. Now that this match has happened, it's like, well, what does he matter anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
She could pity him. Why would she pity him?
Because he has no idea that he's, like, pursuing like something that's just never gonna happen.
I think that's one way, or maybe it's just like he's a lowdown creature.
He's a lowdown,
he doesn't
yeah.
know the kind of love that I have, right?
That could be it too. It's a godlike pity. He knows not what he does. The Wallaces, she had amusement in understanding them.
Meaning what?
I don't know, just like she finally gets to meet them.
I think it's like she has the inside scoop from Mrs. Smith, right?
Gotcha.
That's what I think. I'm not sure if it's certain.
The Wallaces, she had amusement in understanding them. Lady Dalrymple and Miss Carteret, they would soon be innoxious cousins to her.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. She cared not for Mrs. Clay and had nothing to blush for in the public manners of her father and sister.
Mm. Well, why are Lady Dalrymple and Miss Carteret going to just be innoxious cousins to her soon?
Because she's leaving?
I can, because she doesn't have to live with Sir Walter and Elizabeth anymore, right?
That's right, yeah.
Carrot doesn't care about Mrs. Clay anymore, and either Sir Walter and Elizabeth behave very well, or she's just not paying attention to them.
Yeah. With the Musgroves, there was the happy chat of perfect ease. With Captain Harville, the kind-hearted intercourse of brother and sister. With Lady Russell, attempts at conversation, which a delicious consciousness cut short. I love that. With Admiral and Mrs. Croft, everything of peculiar cordiality and fervent interest, which the same consciousness sought to conceal. And with Captain Wentworth, some moments of communication continually occurring, and always the hope of more, and always the knowledge of his being there. That's really nice.
Aw. I like this. Well, first of all, this party is so anticlimactic. This party was sort of being set up as, like, something where events are going to happen.
Yeah, but there's this huge entrance with Elizabeth and Sir Walter handing out invitations.
It's like, oh, is Wentworth going to come or not? Yeah. Right? Yeah. And it turns out they just resolve. The party is like their victory lap, basically.
They resolve, hours before the party starts.
Everything starting with the Musgroves on. So first we hear about Mr. Elliot, the Wallaces, Lady Dalrymple, Miss Carteret, Mrs. Clay, Elizabeth and Sir Walter, blah, blah, blah. And then everything from the Musgroves on is Anne's new family. These are, like, all the people she's leaving behind. Mr. Elliot, Miss Carteret, her own family, Sir Walter and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And then the Musgroves is her new family. The family that she has, like, forged in throughout this book.
Yeah.
The Musgroves, Captain Harville, who they say they're, like, a brother and sister. Lady Russell is still part of her, Anne's new family, even though she knows a little bit more than Lady Russell does now.
Mm-hmm.
Admiral Mrs. Croft, who will soon literally be her family.
Right.
And, of course, Wentworth.
Mm-hmm. It was in one of these short meetings, each apparently occupied in admiring a fine display of greenhouse plants, that she said.
Oh, I also just want to say, I love this, like, it was a commonplace party, you know. It was but a mixture of those, blah, blah, blah. It was one of those short meetings. It's so, like, I love, like, the nostalgia of how it's described. And also, just, like, the juxtaposition of, like, it was just, like, another commonplace night. But underneath it, this was the happiest night of Anne's life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Glowing. She's glowing.
Uh-huh. And they're apparently only admiring greenhouse plants. But, in fact, they're, you know, thinking of something else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it was in one of these short meetings, which each apparently occupied in admiring a fine display of greenhouse plants, that she said, I have been thinking over the past and trying impartially to judge of the right and wrong, I mean with regard to myself, and I must believe that I was right, much as I suffered from it, that I was perfectly right in being guided by the friend whom you will love better than you do now.
Like,
don't, yeah, you'll love her. You'll come around to her.
Don't worry, yeah.
To me, she was in the place of a parent. Do not mistake me, however. I am not saying that she did not err in her advice. It was perhaps one of those cases in which advice is good or bad only as the event decides. Like Schrodinger's advice. And for myself, I certainly never should, in any circumstance of tolerable similarity, give such advice. But I mean that I was right in submitting to her, and that if I had done otherwise, I should have suffered more in continuing the engagement than I did even in giving it up, because I should have suffered in my conscience. I have now, as far as a sentiment is allowable in human nature, nothing to reproach myself with. And if I mistake not, a strong sense of duty is no bad part of a woman's portion. So she kind of just, like, rehashes what we've said, that, like, yeah, like, Lady Russell, her advice was sort of, like, given in error, like, maybe she didn't, like, it was, like, not the best advice, and I personally wouldn't give it, but I followed it because it was the right thing to do. And if I didn't follow the advice, I probably would have judged myself for, like, kind of going against my family.
Mm-hmm. Well,
which we know.
I like this. I like the kind of, like, I think this is an important paragraph, even though not a lot of new information comes out. It's important, like, Anne's statement that she says. Like, earlier in her conversation with Wentworth, she's like, if I was wrong in breaking up the engagement.
Mm.
And she's clearly been thinking about it all day, all night. And she now is, like, telling Wentworth, you know what, I've been thinking about it more, and I was right, actually. I was 100% right in giving you up the first time.
Yeah.
And I think that this, like, realization by Anne makes this so much of a stronger narrative. It's not like, oh, look at all this time that we wasted. It's like, this was necessary. I was right to give you up at first. The biggest mistake of my life was actually the right decision, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such a tragic thing that, it was such a tragic thing for her to give up. But yeah, in that moment, it was the right thing to do. Mm. Even, you know, even as ridiculous as her family is, it was still like, the proper thing for her to do.
And I think she's able to realize this because now Wentworth is back. Mm-hmm. Because now they've, that hasn't prevented them from getting married. If anything, now their love is so much stronger because of it. And their marriage is, like, they're both in so much better of a place to get married.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay.
And so, yeah, it's also Anne, like, owning her own decisions, you know?
Yeah, like, this isn't, yeah, like, right. This is her saying, like, at the end of the story, being like, I didn't make a mistake. This isn't, these past, like, 8 years hasn't been the result of a mistake. It's been a result of actually doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it led to misery, but at least I still can say with confidence that I did the right thing.
And Lady Russell is not a villain. Maybe I wouldn't give the same advice, but she was basically my parent. She was the closest thing I had to a reasonable parent at that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me not to do it. I did right by following her advice.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow. That's like, your misery was because you made the right choice.
That's why, you know, if a lesser writer might have made Lady Russell to be the villain, you know, given her duplicitous reasons or whatever, or at least making her just seem like outright, you know,
like unintelligent, just like a snob,
or a snob. But in fact, Lady Russell, you know, maybe she was a little bit misguided, but she's not a villain by any means. She was acting in Anne's best interest.
Yeah.
And you know what, Wentworth, you're going to come around to like her. You're going to love her, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it also just does it. It makes the narrative more worth it, you know?
Yeah.
These people haven't just been wasting their time. They've been, like, it's been a journey. And it's been a, you know, a journey they have to complete in order to get together.
Yeah. It honestly, like, if you think about it, it makes for a more satisfying ending than for it to just say, like, this is their, like, second chance at love or whatever. Mm. Like, It's all there for a reason, you know? There's a method to this madness that's been happening in their lives.
Right, which is why that's what you want from a good narrative. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't just be, maybe some people disagree, it shouldn't just be a bunch of random stuff that happens, you know, and then two people get married at the end of it.
Yeah, right, exactly, They shouldn't be the same people they were 8 years ago. They should be different people, and they should be better suited to marry each other now.
Right, and if anything, you know, now, like, their love has stood the test.
Yeah, that's also true, yeah. The love has stood the test of, you know, it's almost like Christ-like. Like, she was suffering for a good reason, you know? It wasn't because of a mistake. It wasn't because of something stupid, like a miscommunication. It was like, you know, she suffered, but it was for the right, but it was necessary suffering.
She might have suffered more if she had said yes, you know? Yeah. Sometimes,
well, like, if she had said yes, she would have lost Lady Russell and her family.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, love doesn't triumph overall.
Sometimes love, yeah, like, personal love isn't the most important thing.
Right. Well, I should say, if love will...
conquer all.
It will conquer, but it's gonna be hard, you know?
Yeah.
It will survive through impracticalities, but you have to... it's gotta be a strong love, and you've gotta work for it, right?
Yes, even if it means not being together.
Uh-huh.
That's right. It's not like a... love conquering all as long as we stay together. It's like sometimes, like, true love will be there even after years of absence.
Okay. He looked at her, looked at Lady Russell, and looking at her again, replied as if in cool deliberation, "Not yet, but there are hopes of her being forgiven in time. I trust to being in charity with her soon. But I, too, have been thinking over the past, and a question has suggested itself. Whether there may not have been one person more my enemy, even than that lady, my own self. Tell me if, when I returned to England in the year 8, with a few thousand pounds, and was posted into the Laconia, if I had written to you, would you have answered my letter? Would you, in short, have renewed the engagement then?"
"Would I?" was all her answer, but the accent was decisive enough.
Mm-hmm. Laconia, of course, is a ship.
Yeah.
They talk about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So here Wentworth is like, I know, but I haven't quite forgiven Lady Russell yet, but I will in time, right? And in fact, I've been thinking, and it wasn't the Lady Russell who was the problem, it was myself, right?
Yeah.
When I came back 2 years later and was finally a little bit better set to get married, would you have said yes again, right?
Right. So that's what trips him up. That's why he is his worst enemy, is because he could have proposed again and he didn't.
Uh-huh. They could have only had 2 years of waiting. It's Wentworth's own fault that they had another 6, right?
Yeah.
Good God, he cried. You would. It is not that I did not think of it, or desire it, as what could alone crown all my other success. But I was proud, too proud to ask again. There you go. Mm. Pride, that's not going to work. I did not understand you. I shut my eyes and would not understand you, or do you justice. So here, I think this is... If Anne wins Wentworth's everlasting love by giving him up the first time, this is the journey Wentworth has to go through himself, is realize that, is like get over his own pride, right?
Mm-hmm.
Come back and ask again.
Yeah.
This is a recollection which ought to make me forgive everyone sooner than myself. 6 years of separation and suffering might have been spared. It is a sort of pain, too, which is new to me. I've been used to the gratification of believing myself to earn every blessing that I enjoyed. I have valued myself on honorable toils and just rewards. Like other men under reverses, he added with a smile, I must endeavor to subdue my mind to my fortune. I must learn to brook being happier than I deserve.
All right.
So he's like, I don't deserve you, Anne, right?
That's right.
If I did deserve you, I would have asked 6 years ago.
Yeah, instead he decided to distract himself with playing at war and not thinking critically about Anne's position and the kind of pressure she was under when you first proposed. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, we got one more chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But,
this pretty much sums up the story.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
Anne and Wentworth, those kids finally made it happen. Those crazy kids.
Those crazy kids found each other after all. Yeah, so we have one more chapter. We're not quite done yet, but this is kind of the culmination of the story,
mm-hmm.
as we know it.
Right. They understand each other, and Wentworth understands himself.
Yeah, well, Anne always understood Wentworth.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. This is like Wentworth is the one who really needed to change. Anne, if anything, needed to see that she made the right decision.
Yeah, I guess that is Anne's big journey.
Mm-hmm. Is that she needed to realize, like, I shouldn't regret rejecting him. It was, like, what was necessary.
And I wasn't wrong, you know, in doing it.
Right.
And I think it's easy to have, you know, that perspective when Wentworth's back, right?
Yeah, in the same vein that I'm sure it's easier for him to forgive Lady Russell in time,
right.
Now that they're, like, engaged. Mm-hmm. Well, it's also very interesting. I mean, I can safely say this for now, but like the whole thing with Mrs. Smith's, we'll see, but like, Anne never told Lady Russell about Mr. Elliot's true nature.
She never got around to it.
She kept putting it off.
More important things started coming up. I mean, Mr. Elliot is, like I said, basically like benign and pointless by the end of this book. Like, no longer, like, the best we can do is look at him with some pity.
Yeah. Yeah.
No longer can he wreak any havoc for Anne's happiness.
Right. Like, we also shouldn't pin him too much, because he's going to inherit Kellynch. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we'll just have to see what the final chapter holds for us. But,
Lady Russell herself is, like, even though she's so important here, like, she has really fallen into the background of the book by the end of it also.
Mm-hmm. I agree, yeah.
And it's key. It's more about, like, her presence, and, like, the memory of her than, like, her actually being there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, she really does, like, kind of disappear in the second half of the book. That's because she's part of Kellynch. She's Anne's life in Kellynch. And the story is about Anne not being Kellynch anymore, having her new family.
Lady Russell's the only member of Kellynch that she's going to really bring into her new life.
Yeah.
I'm sure she'll visit Sir Walter and Elizabeth, but they're not going to be part of her new family, nor do they really want to be, probably.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's it for this episode. We only have one more chapter to go, but if you still have things you want to say about the book, we'd be happy to read them. I don't know if we'll be able to read them out loud for the last episode, but if you want to talk to us about the book or about, you know, Jane Austen in general, you can email us at secondimpressionspod@gmail.com.
Yep.
So until the last chapter of Persuasion, I'm Grace.
And I'm Tom.
Bye.